From NPR News, this is Day to Day. The iPhone is going corporate. At least that's what Apple is expected to announce tomorrow. The company is trying to convince other companies to replace their BlackBerries with iPhones. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is here now. And Nancy, is this something the business world is just clamoring for, the iPhone?
Not really, Madeline. In fact, IT departments are generally pretty suspicious of iPhones. So Apple has to convince them that companies wouldn't just be paying for their employees to be able to listen to music on their work cell phones. And Apple has actually quite a bit of incentive to sell to businesses. Its stock is down 35% so far just this year, and that's because sales of iPods have fallen off.
So Apple would also have to convince IT departments, the corporate buyers, that its technology is better than BlackBerry's technology. How would it do that?
Well, it's going to tell companies that it can meet their future needs better than BlackBerry. Apple says the iPhone would be able to handle a lot more than just phone calls and emails. I spoke today with William Markey of a company called RCBG, a telecom consulting firm, and he says Apple could pitch the iPhone as a way for corporate types to be even more mobile.
The iPhone would be a terrific platform, say, for video conferencing, for collaboration, for projecting a PowerPoint, if you will. These are the type of things that smartphone makers are trending towards.
So, Nancy, that would require software that could work on the iPhone, and has that been developed?
Not quite. Apple is actually known for its secrecy, and that's a problem. It's reluctant to share much of anything with software developers, but it will have to give up some of its secrets if developers are going to design software for the phone. Another analyst I talked to today, Chris Silver of Forrester Research, though, says there does appear to be a chink in the Apple armor.
But I think it's encouraging to see that they're offering this software development kit, that they're offering press and analysts and the community that so often is left without information by Apple, that they're openly talking about what they're planning to do here.
Nancy, what is Research in Motion, the company that owns BlackBerry? What are they doing to fight back?
Well, Madeline, they're hardly helpless. In fact, they're stepping onto Apple's turf a little bit. They've been appealing to consumers with BlackBerry phones that are more fun. They come in bright colors. They're rounder, so they don't snag on your clothes. And there's also a price advantage for a BlackBerry. Remember, you pay a premium for an iPhone. It's generally $150 to $200 more than a BlackBerry. So BlackBerry's hardly helpless here. It's definitely going to be fighting back.
Thank you, Nancy. That's Nancy Marshall-Genzer of Public Radio's Daily Business Show Marketplace.
The Federal Communications Commission was created more than 70 years ago to regulate radio, and it later dealt with television. Its critics say it hasn't adapted well to the age of iPods and YouTube. Some members of Congress and former commissioners have suggested restructuring the agency or combining it with the Federal Trade Commission. NPR's Neda Ulaby has the last report in our series on the challenges facing the FCC.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when he helped create the FCC in 1934, could have never, in his wildest New Deal dreams, imagined one day, steps from the Capitol, a big telecommunications lobbying firm would set up a wicked Xbox gaming room connected by cable broadband to players all over the world.
That's the world we're in today. And in that world, there's less reason to have an agency like the FCC micromanaging the marketplace.
Kyle McSlarrow's got reason to talk smack about the Federal Communications Commission. Steps from the game room, he runs the nation's largest cable lobby, which has battled the FCC over numerous issues for years. About 30 million households here in the U.S. get their internet services through cable. McSlarrow says the FCC could begin by rethinking its approach to broadband.
Just think about what it was like when we were teenagers or kids, right? We had three channels on TV, we had no internet, and we had to go to one place to get our phone service. Now you can get hundreds of high definition, let alone analog channels, and you have an internet that exploded.
Critics say the FCC basically treats the internet as if it was a kind of cable service, and wireless spectrum as if it was just for cell phones. Newton Minow is a former FCC chair. More than 40 years ago, he famously advised Americans to watch, to really watch, TV.
I can assure you that what you will observe is a vast wasteland.
Today, Minow says the vastness of the media landscape has overwhelmed an already fraught agency.
The FCC, under the law, is designed to both promote communications companies and at the same time regulate them. So there's an ambivalence in what the FCC is supposed to do.
The commission's biggest challenge, says Professor Yochai Benkler, is to think completely differently about a media environment in which televisions, computers, and telephones are increasingly morphing into each other. Benkler co-directs Harvard University's Center for Internet and Society.
That's what's necessary, a fundamental reconceptualization to an agency that's intended to assure access, open, neutral to everyone.
Benkler says the government is no longer serving passive couch potatoes, but users actively exchanging information. And he says they need service providers who do not manipulate or block how they do that. This is the idea of network neutrality. Gigi Son of the nonprofit group Public Knowledge says to ensure it, the FCC needs to regulate.
Cable companies and telephone companies control 96% of the residential broadband internet lines in this country. That requires some regulation to ensure that they don't use that bottleneck power, that gatekeeper power, to discriminate against applications, services, and content in which they don't have a financial interest.
Communicating with complete freedom of expression should be a top FCC priority, says Reed Hunt. He was the commission's chair under President Clinton.
If it's pornographic, if you're trying to commit an act of terrorism, that's different. But if you wanted to send a message about freedom of choice for women, Verizon has the power to block it. They did last year.
Verizon initially declined to let the group Narrow Pro-Choice America send text messages to supporters, but it reversed its position after public outcry last fall. It's not unusual for companies to interfere with our communications for reasons ranging from flat-out censorship to managing the traffic on their networks. Last month, Comcast was caught blocking a popular file-sharing service that millions of people use to legally exchange large files, PDFs or music, and not so legally share popular current movies, like Jumper.
I got it! Without the machine, they're screwed!
The FCC held a public hearing 2 weeks ago about net neutrality that was largely about Comcast's, well, lack of neutrality, at least in this case. Reed Hunt says going forward, the FCC needs to ensure Americans can communicate in the most modern and effective manner.
Every other country in the world is committed to open networks and competition and has an active broadband strategy. The United States has fallen behind in broadband, in wireless innovation, in the internet writ large.
People who advocate for open networks say we'll get more competition if more companies get to use the pipes. That's how it works in most other developed countries that have switched from state-owned monopolies to privatization. In a Berlin cafe, a group of teenaged French tourists call their parents back home without the trouble of having to switch SIM cards or unlock their cell phones. Monsef Benigni uses his to effortlessly send a friend across the table his favorite song.
I think the use of the mobile phone is very easy, and it's
rapide, comme on dit.
It's very fast.
It's faster in Europe, cheaper, and there are more options. That angers activists like Gigi Son. She was pleased when the House of Representatives launched an investigation into the FCC earlier this year.
The fact that Congress wants to look at what are the problems with the agency's structure, what are the problems with the way the agency does business, is frankly a relief and is long, long overdue.
But other critics say an agency that controls everything from how emergency responders communicate to which words we can say on the airwaves is already too politicized and may need to look elsewhere for models that can remove it from the oversight of Congress and a White House that appoints its commissioners. The next round starts in November. Netta Ulaby, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The switch to digital television is less than a year off, and millions of Americans may not be ready for it.
Now the Federal Communications Commission is mandating that broadcasters do more to tell the public about the impending transition. Joel Rose reports.
The FCC yesterday told broadcasters they must air announcements about the transition to digital TV starting immediately.
Notice how digital's made pretty much everything better?
Until now, educational spots like this one produced by the National Association of Broadcasters had been strictly voluntary. All U.S. broadcasters are scheduled to flip the switch to digital on February 17, 2009. But one FCC commissioner wants to do some real-world tests first.
You know, even Broadway shows open out on the road so they can work out the kinks in the performance.
FCC Commissioner Michael Kopp says he's concerned about one study that shows reception of digital signals can fall off significantly after 35 miles.
It doesn't just fall off a little bit and you get a little hazy picture like an analog. When it falls off in digital, it's gone.
Kopp proposed the tests yesterday in a letter to FCC Chairman Kevin Martin, who expressed some support but gave no indication where or when the tests might take place. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
One team of space dreamers could get $20 million if they can figure out how to get a working data-transmitting rover to the moon. But they have to beat out other teams of space enthusiasts to get the cash. It is a real-life space race to win the Google Lunar X Prize. Now, most of the teams going after this have gobs of money, the support of foundation, a squad of engineers, and are likely to spend far more than the value of the prize of the race to even get there. But there's one team out there taking a little bit of a different approach. They're shooting for the moon, open-source style. Think Wiki Space Race. They're called Team Frednet. To tell us about their plan, the Fred of Frednet, Fred Bourgeois is here. Hi, Fred.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning. So, first of all, why did you decide to go about this in the open-source way and that, hey, kids, let's put a rover on the moon?
Well, when I first heard about the prize, it sounded like something that I could do. We weren't having to invent anything new. So it was the kind of thing that I knew all of the parts, and I knew a lot of the people who could do those parts. So what I really needed to do was just find a way to find the money. And to do this project and pay all of those people would cost $100 million or something in that neighborhood, which I don't have. So it occurred to me that the goal of the prize is to make space more open. So why not make the whole project open and have an open participation, open source team that goes for the moon?
So who has joined up with you so far? Where are they from? How are they qualified? Or maybe they're not qualified. They just have some great idea.
We have surprisingly got some very qualified people. The first people I contacted were two friends of mine, and I was kind of expecting them to laugh at me, and it turns out one of them was involved in the original Apollo lunar lander program.
Didn't know that?
And I didn't know that. We'd worked together for years.
Where'd you work together?
We worked at a compiler company. We worked at a company doing currency analysis, verifying that currency was printed correctly.
And this just never came up that
no.
He worked on this project.
Can you imagine if I just turned to you one day and I was like, "Allison, I've been to the moon." That's cool.
And after that, I created a website, sent a few more emails out, and people started signing up. We got engineers that basically word of mouth. We found people in Australia who had worked on robotics before. We found people from England that knew the people in Australia who had worked on other components of the system before. We found propulsion engineers, also interestingly, from Australia. We have a lot of people from Australia now.
Huh.
We have people from the countries I know of, the U.S., Canada, England, France, Switzerland, Germany, Romania, Serbia, Denmark, India.
It's amazing.
And I think there's something close to two dozen, maybe a few more countries involved now.
Do you have any kids involved?
We actually have two that I know of. One is a high school student, and he tried to pretend he was in college to make us think he was really qualified. And the other is a 13-year-old. I guess he's in middle school now. And he just joined the forum the other day and said, I'm interested in doing this. I don't know if I have any skills. But I just responded to him and said, we'd love to have you in the project because we want kids to learn more about space exploration. And I asked him if he had a robotics club in his school, which he responded that he didn't, but he wanted to start one.
That's excellent. Let's talk about your actual plan, what you can tell us. We don't want to give away any big secrets. What does your craft look like, and what's the plan to get it into outer space?
Well, it's a four-stage process. The first part of the program is buying a commercial launch from one of the rocketry companies here on Earth.
Okay, buy launch, number one.
Buy launch. that's just got a price tag of $6 to $10 million on it.
Oh, that's it. Okay. You
so
get $6 to $10 million.
If any of your listeners happen to have an extra $6 million lying around, we'd love the contribution.
Rich people, public radio listeners. Rich. Go ahead. Number two. What's number two?
Number two, we are building what we call a lunar bus, and that will carry our spacecraft from Earth orbit to lunar insertion and lunar orbit.
All right. Get space bus to lunar orbit. Number three.
Number three, there's a lunar lander, and we have someone working on that part of the project right now. And the lunar lander will carry the rover to the surface of the moon, touch down softly, hopefully near the Apollo 11 landing site.
And, okay, near the Apollo landing site. Number four.
Number four, the rover comes out of the lander and starts traveling around on the surface of the moon, sending back streaming real-time video.
Piece of cake. Yeah.
Sure.
Piece of cake. You're going to get it done, I'm sure.
Hey. We've already got a rover we can drive over the Internet. We did a demo of that on TV back in December. So we have a rover that's located in Michigan, and we can drive it here in California.
Well, you're on your way. We're rooting for you, Fred.
Well, I'm glad.
Fred Bourgeois, the leader of Team FredNet. If you want to help him out, it's an open source project. You have $6 to $10 million.
There are some other teams
around.
Involved, too. There are. Not just FredNet.
Hey, Fred, good
but
luck to you.
They aren't as much fun.
Fred, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Hey, that's it for today's show. The Bryant Park Project is directed by Jacob Ganz. Our staff includes Dan Pashman, Ann Chillog, Wynn Rosenfeld, Angela Ellis, Caitlin Kenny, and Pauline Bartoloni.
The interns, Elsa, Laura, and Will, our friends.
Manoli Weatherall, technical director. Josh Rogerson and Manya Zuba helped.
Trish McKinney's our editor. Laura Conaway edits the website and the blog.
Our senior producer, Matt Martinez. Sharon Hoffman's the EP. I'm Rachel Martin.
I'm Allison Stewart. We're online at npr.org/Bryant Park.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. So, Allison, I'm not a big shopper. I'm just going to fess up right now. For me, it's the fitting rooms. I hate these things. The lines, the fluorescent lights, you never look good, the curtains that never really close all the way.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
So much so that if I can, I actually will, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I discreetly will just be on the sales floor and just slip on, you know, no one's looking, just put on the skirt.
Oh, that's
put
a lot less embarrassing than a curtain that isn't closed all the way, Rachel.
Well, you know, I do that junior high move when nothing really shows and you can, like, put your hands through. Anyway, what's the alternative, really? You can shop online.
Yes.
It all seems so easy. Click, point, buy, until you get the package and the dress you've been waiting for weeks, and it hangs off you like a giant moo-moo.
I had this awful experience online. I ordered a pair of pants that claimed to be ankle length, and it came out to be normal, regular length, and it was about 5 inches too long. And I was assured that online it was the proper length for a shorter person, and it wasn't.
It was a pain because I ended up having to pay for shipping to get there, pay for shipping to return, and the thing never even fit, so I didn't end up with anything in the end, but I had to pay all this money.
I got in the complete wrong size, sent it back, got in the wrong size again. It's just, you know, by the time you get the clothes the right size, you know, it's not winter anymore. You don't need them. So.
Those interviews were conducted by a new company called Size Me Up, which is trying to change the way people shop for clothing online. The company, which was started by 3 University of North Carolina students, has created this online application which provides people with this quick and easy way to translate their size from one label to another. Here to tell us how all of this works is Melissa Adelman.
Adelman,
I'm sorry, a co-founder and partner of Size Me Up. Thanks for coming in, Melissa.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So I'm assuming you must have had some kind of personal problems finding clothes that fit you. Is that what triggered this whole thing?
Absolutely. I'm very tall. For a female, I'm 5'10", and I always had trouble finding an inseam that was long enough to fit me. In some brands, I would take a long, what that company would call a long, and then in other brands, I would try on that brand's long, and it would barely make it past my knees. And I saw the inconsistencies between brands, and I knew that there was a big problem, and especially when it comes to shopping online where you can't try it on, I knew there had to be a solution.
There is also this phenomenon called vanity sizing, which I personally have experienced. When you go and you buy a pair of jeans that you would expect to fit me, like whatever, 8, 9, 10 size jeans. And then I go to another store and all of a sudden I'm a size 2 and I'm like, oh my gosh,
gosh, I'm so skinny.
yeah, it makes you want to buy it, right?
Yeah, because you're a size. But I'm not hallucinating, right? They're doing this on purpose.
Absolutely. And that's what makes it even more difficult to buy online, because how do you know which sizes are, you know, which brands are doing those sizing and which brands aren't?
Yeah. So what did you decide that you needed to do to fix this? What's your solution?
So we came up with an idea for this tool that's going to help people find their right size. Basically, as you said, comparative sizing. It's a new concept. We actually just got it patented in the U.S. and in Canada. And
you want to take a drink of water?
Thank you.
I know. It's hard. Like when you go to, like, say you like a pair of jeans at Ann Taylor, and then you go to Gap. And then you go over to decided to really blow big money in Seven for All Mankind. It's just the
total
sizing is ridiculous. Yeah.
So you've come up with a way where people can actually go into their closet, measure their favorite pieces of clothing, enter this information in your database, and then what do they get for doing that?
Actually, they don't even have to measure it. They just have to know what sizes fit them in their favorite items of clothing. So basically, they would go to our website, sizemeuponline.com, enter their closet. Basically, we call it Share Your Closet. And they enter their favorite well-fitting items of clothing. It's stored in the database. And then when this tool is available on the online retailer site, all they have to do is click the button, and it'll appear with what size that they are in the item that they would wish to purchase.
So just to clarify, so I go to the website, I say, okay, I'm going to pull out this blouse, this pair of jeans, and I enter like a SKU number or some kind of ID number for the piece of clothing?
Really, all you have to enter is the brand, the size, and if there's a style name or a style number on there. That's basically all you need. More information is always more helpful, but that's all you need to get a size recommendation.
And so this program is going to tell me what size I am in a Calvin Klein jean or
it's like
something else?
It's like a absolutely. It's like a currency converter.
Absolutely.
There
that's,
you go.
That's actually what I say to equate it for people who don't understand. It's kind of like a currency converter for different brands.
And who do you think is going to use this?
All the online retailers, we're hoping.
It's not up yet, though, correct?
Right. We're still collecting data because the more data we have on people's well-fitting items, the more information we have about what fits in what brand versus what size. And it's amazing some of the things you get in there. You see people's closets, and some people are a size 0 in one brand and a size 8 in another, and it's really unbelievable. But the more information we get about that, the better our tool is going to be.
Okay. Well, we will look forward to the launch of Size Me Up. Sizemeup.com?
It's sizemeuponline.com.
Sizemeuponline.com.
And our tool is going to be called Size Wand.
Okay. Well, good luck to you. It's a very entrepreneurial venture that you've embarked upon. Melissa Edelman, co-founder and partner of Size Me Up. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, to the moon. Some people are trying to get there. We'll explain why. When a bike messenger shows up at your door with that final signed document you've been anxiously anticipating, the guy or gal's a hero. Now, when a bike messenger nearly wipes you out by buzzing by you and screams at you in the process, that guy or gal, not your best friend. But bike messengers face a bigger problem than your wrath. It seems to be email. And according to a recent article in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, there are fewer face-to-face deliveries going on in that particular city. It reports in the past 10 years, the number of messengers has declined by about 50%. The piece also quotes an Economist article that says New York has seen a drop-off as well. It's a story we ripped off from the headlines of the Seattle paper. But we're going to add this little bit of information. We did a little digging ourselves. The news might not be so grim for the 134,000 cycle couriers out there. According to the Bureau of Labor's website, while, quote, electronic transmission of many documents, forms, and other materials is replacing items that have been hand-delivered, for items that are unable to be sent electronically, such as blueprints and other oversized materials, securities, and passport, couriers and messengers will still be needed. Messengers like Austin Horse, who's been peddling the streets of New York for the past 3 years, who peddled himself up to Bryant Park and is sitting in our studios. Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
You rode your bike here, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, just had to ask. Do you work independently or do you work for a company?
I work for a company. That's more the norm, though maybe as people get more experience and pick up their own clients, they can work independently. And then there's also something called independent contractor status, which you have at some companies.
Get a little closer to the mic. Or don't break it, hon. So can you give us an idea of your average day? How many deliveries do you make?
A good day is 30. You know, I think most guys are pretty happy if they do that. but it's also not so much about how many deliveries you make, but how much they're worth. Some deliveries are worth, more money is charged to the client if we have to go further, if it's heavier, if it's a rush. So if you do a bunch of stuff like that, then it's going to be, then you'll make more money than if you do a bunch of just cheap runs.
So if you look at your docket and you see like, wow, I have to go from Battery Park all the way up to, let's say, Bronx.
You put on your super special
shoes. That's pretty good, right? That's a decent ride?
I mean, that's unusual for a biker to get. A walker would probably get that because they could just hop on the train.
Explain what a walker is.
So there aren't just bikers that are used by courier companies in the city. They also have guys who take the buses and trains, and they're called walkers. Hmm. And then there's also van drivers for stuff that's too big to go with a walker or a bike.
So when I see you, say I'm later on today and I see you whizzing by me on your bike, and you've got your messenger bag, which a lot of us just carry for fashion, but you carry it for real. What kind of things have you been carrying around?
It depends. A lot of CDs and DVDs, stuff that I guess it loses its quality when it goes over the internet. Mm-hmm. So that, hard drives I've carried, payroll, clothing, all sorts of random stuff that just people like have to get over there.
When you're carrying something like payroll, did you carry the payroll for The Sopranos, or is that just a rumor?
Yeah, it's true.
For real?
Did you ever want to look at James Gandolfini's check?
No, we don't do that, you know.
Have you ever been nervous because you've been carrying something that's quite valuable?
Not particularly. Maybe mm-hmm. something that's fragile that I'm worried about. So, yeah, like art stuff. There's documents like get printed, mm-hmm. you know, printing companies. And if you crease that, then that's bad. And then, you know, the packages say, like, do not crease. So I worry about that. Or getting a package wet, like on a rainy day.
Now, I got to imagine safety is a big issue. Sometimes when I'm driving in the city or if I'm walking in New York, and some of these guys get dodging through and in and out of traffic. First of all, do you do that kind of stuff, honestly?
If it feels safe.
If it feels, what does that mean?
Just from experience, you know, you sort of get an idea of what the velocities of things, their trajectories, and maybe you get comfortable with navigating through that. So, yeah, coming down Fifth Avenue, I'll be right amongst the cars as they come down, and I'm comfortable with that. I won't be, like, on the left side waiting for them all to go past.
Have you ever been hit?
I've been hit a few times, but nothing serious, luckily. But it does happen. Like, a guy I know got hit yesterday, and I hear he's in Bellevue, so...
Hope he gets better.
Yeah, Eddie Wonka, I hope you feel better.
Feel better, Eddie. Have you ever hit anybody?
A pedestrian?
Yeah.
It happens. People...
it happens.
what's actually really common, and if, you know, pedestrian listeners are out there, what they should pay attention to, be really careful when you're crossing mid-block between, like, vans, because when you pop out from that, it's pretty hard to stop unexpectedly. That's, like, the most common time that pedestrians will get hit when they're just not paying attention and they step out and the biker's not expecting them. Really, it's actually random things like that mm-hmm. are the biggest hazard as far as that. So cars doing random things, like illegal U-turns that get pulled, stuff like that, or car doors. Car doors are another big hazard.
I've seen that happen. That's ugly.
Not pretty.
Now, are you guys, have you ever seen a messenger get ticketed by police for the way you were riding?
I've seen it happen, yeah. Oh, the way that we've been riding? That's arguable because it's not really – it's hard for the cops to actually stop a riding messenger. Mm. Someone who's, like, on a bike going away from them. They just don't do it. But what they do is they target people who are stopped at red lights. And so I have seen the cops, like, just make up tickets for people who are at red lights.
For something they saw 5 blocks back or something?
No, just something that they made up on the spot.
So says Austin. Doesn't know that for sure. He's like, yes, I do.
Well, there are laws that don't – like there's a law in New York State you have to stay to the right side of the road, but it doesn't apply to New York City. New York City is different. So cops will write tickets for that. Or they'll write a ticket saying that you have to ride in the bike lane when actually the bike lane law is written so that cars aren't supposed to be in the bike lane.
Do you have
it's
to
just
learn...
interpreted as bikes have to be in the bike lane by the cops when it's convenient to them.
Do you have to learn all of these different laws or did you choose to learn all these different laws, bike laws?
Bikes basically have to follow traffic laws, mm-hmm. so you're pretty much set if you follow if you know to follow traffic laws.
Now, you heard the top of our story. Out in Seattle, they're having a problem with bike messengers. I mean, it's a big internet town, and people are sending their documents via email. Do you think there's still a future in bike messengering? Have you seen any sort of slack off? Do you guys talk about this all at all?
It's always a concern. You know, you think, how much money did I make this week as compared to the same time last week. It could be getting worse. It's hard to say. If it is getting worse, maybe there are less people in it, and then you just don't realize mm-hmm. that, or they move on to other things. In New York particularly, though, we have so many other types of business here.
Yeah.
So there's all the clothing, big clothing companies. There's so much stuff that the internet doesn't really affect us because we carry things beyond what you can send via email.
Austin Horst, New York City Bike Messenger, thanks for taking the time. Please be safe when you go out there.
Thank you.
Be safe. Keep your head down.
Yeah, look both ways, you guys.
Wear your helmet. Do you wear your helmet?
It's actually law in New York City for working cyclists to wear a helmet.
There you go.
I was rescued by a bike messenger once. I had a really bad flat up underneath the George Washington Bridge, pulled over. Fixed my bike for me. I tried to get his name to, like, send him a gift certificate or something. No, he said, hey, glad I could help you off. Rode on down the street.
The culture of the bike messenger. Good people.
Bye,
Thank
Austin.
Thank you. Take care.